From KUAR News in Little Rock, this is a look at the weekend news, politics, and more. Coming up,
the filing period for 2016 elections closes with Republican candidates outnumbering Democrats 2-1.
Senator Tom Cotton proposes changes to Social Security's disability program.
Governor Asa Hutchinson prepares for a trade mission to the Far East.
We now know more about the Arkansas Supreme Court's handling of a same-sex marriage case.
As the State Department of Veterans Affairs begins instituting reforms, Veterans Day is marked.
A group of lawmakers and other officials pay a visit to Arkansas's death row with an effort to resume executions underway.
And the Arkansas Symphony makes an announcement as final work is underway in the renovation of the historic Robinson Center Music Hall.
I'm Michael Heplin.
I'm Jacob Kaufman.
I'm Sarah Weitz-Kotacek.
And I'm Chris Hickey.
For the week ending Friday, November 13th, 2015, this is KUAR's Week in Review podcast. On Monday, the filing period for candidates in Arkansas who are planning to run in 2016 came to a close. And Jacob, pretty striking here. By a 2-1 margin, Republicans outnumber Democrats in the overall number of candidates, with 132 Republicans, 67 Democrats, and 17 Libertarians, a few independents in there, and about 150 judicial candidates. But what really struck me is in the House of Representatives, three of the four members from Arkansas in the House are not going to face Democratic challengers.
If there is any doubt in the past about whether Arkansas is fully transitioned into a red state, I think it has to be gone at this point. As you said, that there's very little Democratic opposition at all. Last time around, 2014 midterms, Democrats were saying we're going to be able to bounce back. They had several high-caliber candidates. James Lee Witt ran against Bruce Westerman. Pat Hayes, the former mayor of North Little Rock, ran against French Hill in the 2nd District. But this time around, as you said, there's not a lot of competition at all. There are more Libertarians running for congressional office than Democrats in Arkansas this year. So Democrats have said they've focused most of their energy on the state House races. I think a lot of that is if their problem before was you can't run when Obama's the president for national office, well, maybe they forego that a little bit. But there is some competition. Connor Eldridge is going to run for Senate against John Bozeman, and he's already been noted for raising more money than Bozeman in his first filing report. Diane Curry will be challenging French Hill in the 2nd District. However, her campaign not getting off to such a great start, not even raising $5,000 in her first filing report.
Yeah, and on the topic of the Senate race, Chris, you spoke with Senator John Bozeman. He filed the paperwork on Monday. He will also be facing a challenger for the Republican nomination.
Yeah, that's right. He's only one of a couple of federal elected officials having both a primary challenger and a Democratic challenger in what will likely be the highest profile state race in the 2016 election cycle. Yeah, I caught up with him at a Veterans Day event in North Little Rock on Wednesday, and I asked him if he was concerned about his campaign.
No, I'm going to continue doing what I do. You know, there's been some question about my ability to raise money and things like that. That's the last thing in the world that I've cared about. You know, I've been there to serve, and so you know, all of that'll work itself out. But my primary responsibility is being the state, serving people, whether it's veterans or people with Social Security problems. You know, you name it. And then again, being on five committees in Congress, doing a great job representing the people there.
And you mentioned Jacob, and Bozeman mentioned there's been concerns about his fundraising. And as we mentioned last week on the podcast, Bozeman was admonished by the Republican National Committee for possibly not raising enough money. But Bozeman kind of skirted or brushed off those concerns a bit. There's also an issue with his name recognition in the state. And there's the Arkansas poll last week showed that, you know, he probably doesn't have as much name recognition as a statewide public elected official should have. And an anecdotal example of this at this Veterans Day event, which we'll talk about later, I was walking out of the gymnasium over there in North Little Rock and passing Bozeman in the hallway. I was walking next to a family, like an older woman in her 60s and her two grandchildren who are teenagers. And as politicians do, Bozeman came by and he was like, "Hey, how are y'all doing?" You know, shook their hands. And later, as I was walking with them, the two teenagers seemed to think that they had just spoke to Tom Cotton, and it wasn't Tom Cotton at all. I told them, well, no, that's John Bozeman. And they're like, who? So, you know, obviously that doesn't, that particular example does not represent the entire body politic of the state, but it might illustrate just a little bit of maybe some of the challenge that Bozeman faces. Yeah. Getting his name out there.
Yeah, and he isn't as high profile as Tom Cotton because Tom Cotton is constantly on the network news programs. But Bozeman facing a challenge from Curtis Coleman, most recently ran for governor, has also run for office before that. But any thoughts about whether or not he could give Bozeman a real challenge?
My thought about it is that when Coleman ran against Asa Hutchinson, who's another person who'd been in the state for a while, maybe hadn't had the greatest success, but he's governor now, Coleman didn't get more than, I think, 26 or 30%, maybe in any single county. So he'd have a big uphill battle, I think, to defeat Bozeman. Even though Bozeman's fundraising numbers are kind of weak, he still raised about $500,000, was just barely under Connor Eldridge's fundraising total. So he's still a very strong candidate. And everyone I spoke with who conducted the Arkansas poll, they said, even though he has a high rate of people who don't know who he is, he's still generally well-liked for an incumbent. And his numbers aren't seen as putting him in any particular threat at this point. Coleman has never mounted a successful campaign on a statewide or regional basis before. So it'd be a tremendous, I think, historic upset if Coleman won the primary.
Well, on the subject of Senator Tom Cotton, Jacob, he detailed legislation on Monday at a forum held by a conservative think tank, the Heritage Foundation, a proposal to reduce the number of disability beneficiaries. Explain what he's introducing.
Sure. And Tom Cotton, as you mentioned before, we usually think of him in national news relating to foreign policy issues with Iran or something like that. And that's something he wants to spend most of his time on. But he sees that the high rate of disability use, particularly in Arkansas and in other rural southern states, he calls it Greater Appalachia. Arkansas is the second highest rate of disability use in the country. I think it's around 8.4%, over 7% in any rate. And so he said these as a three-planked platform to try to fix high disability use. But before we get into that, here's Senator Cotton at the Heritage Club in Washington, D.C., stating his case for why something needs to be done. He says America is at a tipping point when it comes to disability use.
There seems to be, at least at the county and regional level, something like a disability tipping point. Disability becomes a norm. It becomes an acceptable way of life and an alternative source of income to a good-paying full-time job, as opposed to a last resort safety net program to deal with catastrophic injury and illness. After a certain point, when disability keeps climbing and becomes endemic, employers will struggle to find employees or begin or continue to move out of the area. Population continues to fall and a downward spiral kicks in, driving once thriving communities into further decline. Not only that, but once this kind of spiral begins, communities could begin to suffer other social plagues as well, such as heroin or meth addiction, and associated crime. An urgent policy goal, therefore, should be to stop these tipping points from being reached. There's nothing compassionate about accepting these rates of disability usage.
And so the Democratic Party of Arkansas found a lot to object to when Tom Cotton kind of referred to the use of disability as a social plague that could then lead to drug use and other vices like that. Democratic Party Chair Vincent Insulaco said in a statement, he said he doubted that the senator would have made that speech to a room full of disabled Arkansans. He said it's by calling it a social plague. He's attacking about 150,000 Arkansans who are on disability, some of those who are perhaps the most vulnerable of our state. And the Social Security Administration also, the past month or so, Social Security disability is now 60 years old. They issued a report trying to show who's using it. Is this the intent that people had 60 years ago? And their general argument is, the people on Social Security disability are the people who the founders of the program intended it to be. They don't think there's a lot of fraud or abuse, and the people's work history is about the same as those as anyone else. They can't find anything really to say this is a group of people who would abuse the system. But Senator Cotton, he had three main planks in his plan. The first one was to change the amount of classification. So one could be you're permanently disabled. One could be we expect you to get better in a year disabled. So once we have those new classifications, he also wants to allow people to work more while getting disability benefits so they can work and get some benefits without being afraid of making too much money to lose their benefits. And the third thing would be, and maybe the most controversial, is when you get designated for a particular disability, he wants there to be a timeline at the beginning put on for when you're supposed to be better. And when that timeline is gone, if you're still disabled, it's up to you to reapply in time. So that's one concern. The Democrats would say that's putting government bureaucrats before doctors, which is kind of interesting when you hear healthcare talk. It's kind of the opposite of what normally happens from different parties. But it's just the very beginning of this legislation. He outlined it for the first time this week. He has yet to formally introduce it to the Senate.
And any indication yet whether or not this would get backing from any of his colleagues?
I'm not quite sure about this. I imagine that if Tom Cotton rolled it out, he already has some people in mind that would support it and back it. Welfare reform is something that is traditionally very popular. Bill Clinton led welfare reform when he was president, and high disability use, particularly in Arkansas, it is 8.4%. We're the second highest in the country for disability use. But other states, the other spectrum, Hawaii, less than 3 people use it. California, only 3.2% people use disability use. So while it is a big problem maybe for those states in Arkansas or Kentucky or Tennessee, it's not necessarily as big a problem in other states.
This weekend, Governor Asa Hutchinson will be departing on a trade mission to Japan and China. And Chris, you covered the governor this week as he was getting ready for this. Talk a little bit about what he's hoping to accomplish and the goals of this trip.
Yeah, he spoke to reporters after he made a short address to the 87th annual meeting of the Arkansas Chamber of Commerce in Little Rock. And he's leaving on Sunday, looking to attract some more Japanese companies to Arkansas. Hutchinson says 18 companies from Japan already have operations here, but 0 Chinese companies have operations here. And that's one thing he wants to try to convince Chinese manufacturing companies in particular. He's also looking to introduce an export market from Arkansas to China, particularly in the realms of poultry or agricultural products. And he seems to indicate that China is a little reluctant about U.S. industrialized agriculture. And one of his points is he wants to reassure Chinese officials that the agricultural products, the farm-raised animals, are safe to consume.
We want to be able to assure China of our biosecurity, and that's a very specific message that I want to convey to make sure their markets are open. We actually want to invite the Chinese agricultural commissioner to come here and to see our biosecurity, so they'll have a great deal of confidence in it. It's world class. They need to understand that. And they also need to understand the importance of it for their own society, so they invest in it. The consumer will pay for that extra level of expense in biosecurity. So that's one specific message. Whenever you look at Walmart, they're a huge presence there, but we want to make the connection between Walmart and Arkansas and to capitalize on the well-known business entity of Walmart in China, their presence there, with opportunities for this state. And making that connection hopefully will encourage people to say, yes, that could be a good opportunity for us and a good state to look at.
So yeah, he's leaving on Sunday, and it's a continuation of one of a string of trips abroad to promote the industry of Arkansas. And it's unclear whether or not it'll be effective, but I guess we'll see in the years to come.
Right. And this comes not long after his trip to Cuba. Interesting him going to places that a lot of people don't really consider to be friendly to the United States. There are a lot of concerns expressed about China, the suggestion government hacking of U.S. corporations and the federal government, Cuba, still some people not happy with the normalization of relations with Cuba and the long history going back more than a half century. But interesting, the governor really making these trips to places that aren't really considered U.S. allies, per se.
Yeah, and it might be a pragmatic realization that, you know, at least in the case of China, for instance, I mean, they're one of the U.S.'s largest trade partners. And so I think Hutchinson's goal is just to carve out a name for the state within that larger context.
Well, it was a year ago that the Arkansas Supreme Court heard oral arguments concerning the state's ban on same-sex marriage, a constitutional amendment that defined marriage as being between one man and one woman. Circuit Judge Chris Piazza earlier in the year ruled that that was unconstitutional, and the case was eventually appealed, went before the state Supreme Court. Typically, when you have cases, at least in recent years, go before the court, a ruling comes out within a few weeks. But we didn't get a decision for months. Actually, it wasn't until the U.S. Supreme Court weighed in about 5 or 6 months after that and made the Arkansas Supreme Court, any decision from them, moot. But we recently have learned from an interview with a justice whose term ended at the end of last year that they did indeed actually vote to uphold the judge's ruling, striking down the ban on same-sex marriage.
And this all comes from an interview with Ernie Dumas, a longtime columnist and reporter in Arkansas who's covered state government since the early 60s. He did an interview with Justice Donald Corbin, a retired justice now at this point. He was not when the Supreme Court in Arkansas first started hearing this case. And he did an interview for the Supreme Court and put it up on their website. They're doing oral histories of different court justices. And Arkansas Times blog published it, and I think that's where a lot of people read it. There weren't a lot of people going to the Supreme Court's oral history blog, I guess, firsthand and trying to report off of this. But the interview is really interesting. It was about 30 or 40 pages, covered his entire life from where he was born and what his father did to some of these bigger cases that happened. And Justice Corbin said that the court made the decision, that he even offered to write the dissent, even though he was in the majority, but none was ever released. And this was his term ended in January. Some new justices came in and after that. But I read a little bit of the interview, and Justice Corbin, he said, "I'm about as heterosexual as you can get on a lot of things." So maybe not a natural position for him to take, but he saw this is the matter of the law. This is what is legal. This is what isn't. He had previously ruled in two other cases in Arkansas, one about the state's sodomy laws and allowing gay people to adopt children and be foster parents. In both those instances, he ruled in favor of allowing a broader human sexuality to be legal, basically. But it was a really interesting interview, and you know, he said that he can't exactly say why the opinions weren't ever released. Part of it wasn't up to him. It was up to the chief justices at the time. But he did say that he, and he assumes many other justices, got a lot of threats and a lot of intimidating letters. And one of them, he mentioned that there are a lot of churchgoers that sent him threatening letters. He referenced the Family Council with Jerry Cox. He referenced Jason Rapert. He said that he really strongly considered trying to find him in contempt of court, but he was dissuaded from it. But it was very politically contentious, and maybe that's probably the context of why he wasn't released.
And when a decision didn't come out before the end of the year, you then had a new justice come in there, and then there was the debate about who should actually decide it. The justices who heard the case or the current makeup of the court, and that stretched it out. But to a degree, obviously, judges are elected to the Arkansas Supreme Court, and there's a lot of politics. And he alluded to that in this interview.
Right, he did with those other things, with state legislators threatening him, saying that they might try to impeach judges for certain rulings. Especially they did that with Circuit Judge Chris Piazza after his ruling. But he said because of all of this, you know, he constantly was in communication with state police. He's kept a gun at his bedside for a number of years. And he says in some ways it was my sense of it, at least, was that it was a little bit familiar to him based on those foster parent rulings from 2008 from before. But and one other thing, referencing a previous case, I think it was the foster parents case, and talking about how politicized it is to be a judge in Arkansas because of the elections, he had a quote where he said, "I knew this could get me beat somewhere down the line if I ruled this way." But he ruled that way anyway. He said, "We're not a bunch of wallflowers in the Supreme Court. We're not accustomed to being that way." Although now he seems like he might be a little critical of the current Supreme Court.
But now, as we see, candidate filings, I mentioned about 150 judicial filings, and you're already seeing ads now, say, for the Supreme Court, the Chief Justice position. And these judges have to kind of take the position of candidates, try to appeal to the broad spectrum, the typical Arkansan who is likely to go to the polls.
And one of them, Sean Womack, has been very vocal as a legislator, at least, in passing a whole bunch of anti-gay laws. I think one of them was the foster parent ban. So it's interesting that he is now running for office for this.
Wednesday was Veterans Day, and in North Little Rock, a ceremony took place here in Arkansas with Governor Asa Hutchinson, as well as other elected officials, as well as those who represent the military. And Chris, this comes at a time when the State Department of Veteran Affairs is beginning to institute policy reforms. Tell me a little first, I guess, about the ceremony, but also what's being considered in the discussion.
Right. So this ceremony took place in North Little Rock at Lehman Library. Governor Asa Hutchinson, as you mentioned, spoke, thanked people for their service, highlighted some specific examples of Arkansans who had performed bravely in their act of service. Also speaking was the Department of Arkansas Veterans Affairs, Matt Snead, and he was appointed by Governor Hutchinson in January. And the department, the ADVA, or ADVA as they call it, assists in tandem with the Federal Department of Veterans Affairs, the 250,000 or so veterans who are here. And one of the major initiatives that Snead put in place when he took the role was to assemble a group of about 10 people, both stakeholders within the department and other veterans, to come up with a strategic plan for the department. And one thing they were considering is looking at how some of the department's employees who assist veterans in finding work or finding benefits or kind of navigating the system could better serve that constituency. And here he is talking about that aspect of this strategic plan that they came up with.
If you look at the law says that we're responsible for the activities, the training, and the accreditation of the county veteran service officers. They're appointed by the county judge, but we own the program. And we were not, that program was very ineffective. We had all of our state agency veteran service officers located at Building 65, kind of in bed, if you will, with the VA in North Little Rock, and in a kind of a passive posture waiting for veterans to come see them to help them file a claim. That's not what the law says the Veteran Service Officer Network's supposed to do. We're supposed to connect all state and federal benefits and services, not just VA. So that was a, under the strategic plan, that was strategic goal number one.
So that's one of the main things they're focusing on is training and getting those veteran service officers in separate counties throughout the state accredited and, making sure that they know how to assist veterans in navigating, you know, what's out there for them. Some of the other aspects of the strategic plan, the department is establishing eight new districts around the state, and they'll have offices and staff. And they're also kind of working on a rebranding of the agency. And one of Snead's points was, you know, veterans are sometimes seen as liabilities on the job because of reports of mental health issues stemming from PTSD and traumatic brain injury. And while that is certainly an issue that needs to be addressed. Sneed says there might be a public perception out there, at least among employers, that those issues might harm the effectiveness of veterans in the workforce. So he wants to really work to correct that. And they're also coming up with a long-term plan for care for veterans in the state. They help run the veterans home in Fayetteville, and there's one under construction in North Little Rock. So they're working on that, and it'll be interesting, I guess, to see, you know, how effective they are and whether or not, you know, veterans find the services rendered by this department helpful at all. So, and this, of course, comes in light of a national issue, the Federal Department of Veterans Affairs. There was a law passed last year by Congress to kind of speed up the wait times and increase personnel at the federal department for veterans seeking health care. And part of that is veterans are allowed now to seek care at private providers and file claims with the federal agency. But there's also an issue with that now because sometimes those claims are not reimbursed to the private providers. So sometimes private providers are reluctant to take the veteran benefits. So a number of public elected officials are working on that. And, you know, the Arkansas department is also working to assist veterans with the VSOs, as they call it, and try to navigate the system, file claims effectively, follow up and do things like that.
Well, it's been 10 years since Arkansas last carried out an execution. There was an effort by the governor and others to resume executions in the state, but that is now on hold as a case works its way through the courts. And Sarah, a unique visit this week. A group of lawmakers and other officials actually traveled down to the Varner Supermax prison down in southeast Arkansas to get a firsthand look at death row, the death chamber. Tell me what this visit was about and the goal of these folks seeing the facilities firsthand.
Well, a group of legislators asked the Department of Correction to have a tour of the inmates to see how they live on death row and to see the chamber itself and to get a real step-by-step understanding of how the execution process will work now. A law was passed in the last session that was sponsored by Representative Rebecca Petty. Her daughter, over a decade ago, was murdered, and the man who was convicted of that crime is on death row. And she made it her mission to advocate for the rights of victims' families to see execution. So since that law was passed, the department has expanded the space for viewers to witness executions. They're going to allow family member witnesses to immediately witness the executions in the next room, which is new. And family members of the inmates won't be allowed to witness the executions. There's a second room where there'll be a streamed feed, a video feed that's not going to be recorded. So the goal was to follow up on those changes. And then, of course, there's been the controversy around the drug secrecy and executions taking place in other states where there's been a lot of pain and seemingly not easy deaths. And so I'm speculating that lawmakers wanted to see the space and get an understanding of the process, kind of grappling with what will happen really when the executions begin here in Arkansas.
And you were not able to record audio, but you went along with this group. Describe visually, just kind of describe what the prison and death row in particular and the execution chamber, describe a little more what it actually looked like in your experience being there and seeing this firsthand.
Well, Cummins Prison and Varner Supermax are down the road from each other, and they're about 30 minutes south of Pine Bluff. And when I drove up, they had a gang of prisoners in white led by guards on horseback. And I had seen that in a Pine Bluff prison before, and it definitely seemed like a old-fashioned kind of image. But yeah. The Varner Supermax itself is the state's highest security prison. It's not just for death row inmates. It's for prisoners who get in for any kind of offense and don't behave in prison. They get put in isolation. A report this year came out showed that Arkansas actually has the highest percentage of inmates in isolation. So the prison has two layers of barbed wire fence and towers around the outside. And then there's a security entrance with metal detectors and then gates that have to be opened at various points. Inside the main housing area for the single cells, there's a sort of a central command or officer post on a second story level that looks sort of with a maybe more modern version of a panopticon kind of approach, where that officer can see or guard can see the three rows of cells on either side of them. And then there's another guard on the ground level sort of open, and guards will go to the cells and visit the inmates. So the first level, the first ground floor, is where the death row inmates are. And they have, you know, I can describe the cells, but we actually walked through one that was open and walked by, and kind of we could hear some of them yelling or talking depending on where their cells were situated. They had certain amplification, sort of irregular amplification abilities. So it was a lot to take in.
Yeah, it's a noisy place. I'd interviewed a death row inmate back in 1996, and he had converted to Buddhism and talked about he would wake up at 4 a.m. because it was practically the only time he could get peace and quiet enough to do his meditation. Well, you also spoke with one of the officials who helped organize this.
Right. So I spoke with her. There were two parts to the tour, the Varner Supermax portion. I asked her about just describing the conditions of the inmates there, and then also about what are some of the things come the day of the executions that she's on the parole board. She's also a professor at the University of Arkansas, Little Rock. But what are some of the things that officials who've been working towards preparing worry most about on the day of execution?
And this is Mary Parker Reed.
Well, you worry about a lot of things because it's a very highly emotional day for a lot of people. You worry about the victims' families, and you worry about the offenders' families, and you worry about the offender themselves. But from a process, we worry about the courts and issuing a stay and how that plays into, you know, how the execution proceeds. And it's never easy when you're involved in the death of an individual, but we are mandated by the state of Arkansas to carry out executions, and we will do that to the best of our ability.
How much is the possibility that the drugs might take a difficult course, or the inmate might respond very badly, or they might not work?
Our expectation is that will not happen. We have never used midazolam in our protocol. It is the new first drug of the three drug cocktail, and so there's always an unknown whenever you use drugs, whether it's an unknown drug or whether it's a drug we've used previously, because those drugs are interacting with the human body. We have researched everything we can possibly research. We have talked to everybody we can possibly talk to make sure that our protocol will carry out the execution in a safe and humane way for that individual who is being executed. We never want to be in a position where we're causing anyone undue pain. We never want to be in a position where we're causing major discomfort to anybody.
And the case that halted the eight executions that were planned, one of them, the first double execution, was scheduled for last month. The case that actually halted that focuses on whether or not the state can keep secret the source of the three drugs used in the execution process. What's the status at this point on that lawsuit by nine death row inmates?
Right now, there's actually no hearing scheduled in that lawsuit because the various parties are in the process of replying to one another, and so it's stalled. Another piece I learned about the issue of secrecy when we went to the execution chamber, the Department of Correction head Wendy Kelly walked us through what steps are involved and who is there, and both the executioner and the person who inserts the IV are both volunteers, and she wouldn't say what qualifications they needed to have those roles, but obviously a medical doctor or medical personnel would be prevented by the Hippocratic Oath from participating in execution, and they use volunteers because they don't want those people to be tracked down, and they want them to remain anonymous.
Well, that case will be ongoing, obviously. Governor Asa Hutchinson, prosecutors, as well as families of the victims, have been adamant about resuming executions, but there is talk that that may not be possible, that many states, there could eventually be some kind of ruling from the U.S. Supreme Court on this. But certainly there are people who are continuing to advocate this, and I'm sure we'll find out what happens. And then finally, this week, it's about a year now until the Robinson Center Music Hall reopens to the public. 2 years ago, in 2013, Little Rock voters approved an initiative to fund a major renovation project, basically to modernize the facility. And on Thursday, the Arkansas Symphony Orchestra, which will be holding this year's Opus Ball, its annual fundraiser, announced plans for next year's fundraiser. And they invited folks, including the First Lady, Susan Hutchinson, and others to get a look at the facility as they announced plans for next year, which will actually be in the new facility. Here's a report I put together on that. The 2016 Opus Ball will be held 1 year from now, when a $70 million renovation of Robinson Center Music Hall is complete. Cindy Murphy is co-chair of the event. She made the announcement standing where a new ballroom is being constructed at the top of the building.
The symphony will be coming home. For the first time, they'll actually have their own ballroom in Robinson, overlooking the beautiful river, in the very building where the Arkansas Symphony entertains thousands upon thousands of Arkansans every year.
After the announcement, a tour was given showing progress of the renovations.
This is the historic lobby level. This is kind of a breakout space right through those doors right there.
Inside the main hall, new balconies are being built, and scaffolding is now in place from the floor to the ceiling. As home to the ASO, music director and conductor Philip Mann says he's excited seeing the progress.
In my past, I was involved in several other hall projects and have a background in engineering, and to see the bones of this building exposed right now and to kind of envisage what the completed concert hall is going to look like is absolutely extraordinary. This is a game changer for the Arkansas Symphony. It's a watershed moment really for the entire state. We have the potential for a world-class hall with world-class acoustics where people can really appreciate the fine orchestra that we have here in Arkansas.
The project is on schedule and on budget, says Jim Rice, Chief Operating Officer for the Little Rock Convention and Visitors Bureau, which manages the venue.
What we're working toward now is getting what's called dried in, to where all of the work is inside. And that has worked out very well because by the middle of the winter, we'll be inside. It'll be temperature controlled, should go very quickly or remain on schedule. And so far, all systems are go. We're in very good shape.
The project is being funded by a 2% hospitality tax approved by Little Rock voters in 2013. Michael Heplin, KUAR News.
Michael, in addition to the renovation going on at Robinson, we've been talking a lot about other downtown reconstruction with I-30 and other things like that. Do you have any idea how Broadway Bridge is coming along? I guess you saw it while you were there.
Yeah, actually, when I was up there in the space where this new ballroom is being constructed, didn't have a lot of description on it, but they do now have the glass in place. They're putting in walls there in the ballroom. And I was able to look out there and actually took several photos of the Broadway Bridge. They've taken off the ramps leading up to it. You've got cranes in position, and they're working to actually begin the process, have everything in place so that they can. The goal is to do this project as quickly as possible, but it looks like the Highway Department is ramping up for this, getting the equipment and everything needed. So once they do actually close the Broadway Bridge, begin the demolition, and then rebuild it, they can do it as quickly as possible. But it was interesting getting to look at that from the vantage point there on top of Robinson Auditorium.
That'll be a state-of-the-art corridor. The bridge will be new. The Performance Art Hall is new. And then, of course, looking across the river, you can see Dickie Stevens Park, which is relatively new, too.
Yeah, yeah. So that's in the works.
Great place to view the fireworks.
I'm sure it will be. I'm sure the ballroom, that's actually a good point. That probably will be one of the best views for seeing the fireworks shows hosted in Little Rock. So with that, we'll wrap up the podcast. I'm Michael Hiplin.
I'm Jacob Kaufman.
I'm Sarah Weitz-Kotacek.
And I'm Chris Hickey.
You can subscribe to the podcast if you're not already on iTunes. You can also hear the podcast each week at KUAR.org. KUAR is an editorially independent service of the University of Arkansas at Little Rock. Our theme music is by Chris Hickey. Thanks for listening.